Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher. Today, America's approach to China is fundamentally different from what it was just a couple of years ago. For years, policymakers in Washington had believed in the idea that China could become a responsible stakeholder in the international system, if only it was given greater opportunities to interact with other nations, to participate in global markets, and to play a role in multilateral institutions. Integrating Beijing into the world order, the thinking went, would have a civilizing effect on China's government. That, however, didn't happen. Instead, over the past decade, we've witnessed the rise of a new and increasingly assertive China under the guidance of Communist Party Secretary and President Xi Jinping. And today, confrontation has come to characterize relations between Washington and Beijing. The sea change in policy has been accompanied by a new, more strident message emanating from China. Gone are the days when Chinese officials talked about their country's quote-unquote peaceful rise and the need for win-win outcomes with the West. Today, China's wolf warrior diplomats tussle with critics on social media in order to defend their government's policies, while officials in Beijing spin conspiracy theories about everything from the origins of COVID-19 to their country's culpability in genocide, all with the goal of improving China's image on the world stage. It's an informational contest with enormous consequences, and no one has watched it more closely than Josh Rogan. Josh is a foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post, as well as a political analyst for CNN. He's also the author of the best-selling Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. If you haven't picked up a copy yet, you should absolutely do so. It's a terrific explainer of the change that has taken place in U.S.-China relations in recent years and what it might mean for the world. All of that makes Josh the perfect person to answer some of my most pressing questions about Chinese policy, Chinese propaganda, and our response to it. Josh, it's great to talk to you.
Great to be with you.
I think a logical place to start here is that change that you describe in your book, Chaos Under Heaven. The current confrontational state of relations between the US and China is really the product of some fundamental reorientations, both in Beijing and in Washington. So how did all of this come about and what does it mean?
Right. Well, it so happens that the monumental change that we've seen in the last few years of the US-China relationship was decades in the making. And for a lot of really interesting reasons, it wasn't publicly acknowledged, much less discussed, much less debated in the community of politics and policy outside of a circle of self-proclaimed China hands. And I think that has a lot to do with how we got here. In essence, what I argue in the book is that there's a generational change going on in Washington, whereby a younger generation, and younger, I say carefully, because this generation is now in their 40s for the most part, came up in a world where the original bet, the original gamble, the original proposal of engagement with China, as explained to us since 1972, was that, and I'm simplifying for the sake of time, but generally the bet was that if we engage and cooperate with the Chinese Communist Party as much as possible and integrate them into our systems as much as possible and invested in them as much as possible and had them invest in us as much as possible, they would liberalize first economically, and that would in turn cause them to liberalize politically, and that would solve all of our problems and avoid the Thucydides trap, and we'd all live together in peace and harmony. At least that was the 22nd version of the basic structure of U.S.-China strategy coming out of Washington since 1972. And it seemed clear to a lot of us in that semi-younger generation for a long time, for since we started professionally in this town, that wasn't working out. Not because it wasn't made on an honest basis, not because we didn't try hard to engage China, because the Chinese Communist Party decided to go another way. And because increasingly it seemed obvious to us, again, in the semi-younger generation, that actually China wasn't liberalizing politically and even economically. And actually, rather than us shaping them, they were taking actions to shape us. And rather than integrating the Chinese economy into our system, that it was increasingly changing our system in ways that were adverse to us. In other words, that they were abusing our engagement in order to take advantage of our system in order to further their interests, which were opposed to ours, that they weren't interested in win-win cooperation as they professed, as much as gaining advantage until the time by which they could alter the first regional and then international order to suit their interests, which are essentially to make the world safe for their system and the survival of the Chinese Communist Party. So for all of that time, it seemed that, you know, there was a resistance to acknowledging this bet for a lot of understandable reasons. And then once Xi Jinping took power and once it became clear during the Trump administration that China was actually taking the great leap backwards, that they were actually becoming more aggressive and more repressive and interfering in free and open societies in malign ways all over the world, that we needed a new, different strategy. And what my book is about is the fact that the first inning of that new game was played by the Trump administration, which was a chaotic mess, as you well remember. And because of that once in a generation shift in U.S. foreign policy towards a more competitive and sometimes confrontational approach to China was badly explained, badly executed, and badly misunderstood, and remains to this day. And you know, what I like to say is that Trump flipped over the chessboard, and there are a lot of good reasons why that chessboard should have been flipped over, but he failed to set it back up again. And when the Biden administration came in to complete that task, they didn't understand the moves that had been made in their absence. And all of that contributes to a situation where we have an increasingly tense relationship that's increasingly operating in two different realities. And this sort of gets to the point of your podcast, which is that as the Chinese Communist Party has become more aggressive, more repressive, more expansionist, and more confident, more bold, it's increasingly not only rejecting the sort of customs and norms of the international system as we like it, and it's also trying to shape the international understanding of the world that we live in, and through massive amounts of propaganda, but also massive amounts of information and cognitive warfare. And that's a part of the China challenge that our system is not mature enough to handle, that part of the threat that we have yet to really discuss openly. We talk a lot about Russian disinformation, but this is a different animal in a lot of ways. And until we can talk about it, until we can understand it, we can't even hope to confront it. And that's a microcosm of the overall challenge we have with China today.
All right, so let's drill down on precisely that, because you're absolutely right. There are monumental changes that are taking place in policy, but they're also taking place in the information domain. And here, a perfect example, I think, is COVID-19. The outbreak of the coronavirus in early 2020 dramatically reconfigured the world in ways that are still being felt today. And China is central to this story. And this is both because of where the virus came from and because Beijing has exploited the resulting crisis to attempt to reshape the global order in some pretty fundamental ways. So talk about that a little bit. How has Beijing navigated this issue? What have Chinese policymakers been saying about the disease itself and about its origins?
Right. Well, you know, in about 20 years of reporting on U.S.-China relations, I've never seen such a drastic catastrophe on the part of China's policy than their handling of the COVID-19 pandemic from start to finish, including up to this day. And I'll explain what I mean by that. You know, we often like to see the relationship in Washington because we're so solipsistic. We think everything's about us. We think if we just craft the right policy, then it's all going to work out. And all that we really need to do is have a great process to get the smartest strategy. And then we're going to get the outcomes that we want. But actually, you know, a lot of what's happened surrounding China's role in the world and international perceptions of China's role in the world has very little to do with us at all. It has to do with what the Chinese Communist Party has done and is doing. Okay. And there's no bigger example of this than the coronavirus pandemic, because of course it affected every single human being on Earth. 7 billion people all of a sudden understood in a moment that what happens in Beijing doesn't stay in Beijing, or what happens in Wuhan doesn't stay in Wuhan. And it became obvious and undeniable to every human being on Earth that the actions, in this case, the misactions of the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese government, can affect their lives in ways that cause great suffering for them in their communities and their families and their economies. So how did China perform, right? How did the Chinese government perform when it was tested, when it had all of the leadership advantage, all of the first mover advantage? It knew the most about the virus. It had all the labs, apparently, right? And I don't think you could find any honest person in any country who doesn't have a minder standing over them or a gun to their head who would say that it was anything but catastrophic. And they'll start with the outbreak, which they handled like most authoritarian regimes handle crises. Think of Chernobyl. They hit it for months, and we don't know how many months, but a lot of months, just like they did with the first SARS virus. And think about the effect that had. And then once they couldn't hide it anymore, they lied about it. They lied to the World Health Organization about the human to human transmissibility. Then they deny the access by the international inspectors and so on and so on. So the cover up started before we even knew about the outbreak. And that undoubtedly caused immense suffering and a worsening of the pandemic from the start. Then you get into how they handled the origin story. Now, we can get into this as a separate issue. For those of you who have read the book or heard me talk about this, my position is very clear that there are two possible ways that this virus was released into humanity. One is through a natural random spillover, and the other is through some relationship to all of the bat coronavirus labs near the outbreak. And I happen to think that the evidence for the latter theory is much more compelling. It continues to mount, but we can get into that later. The point here is that the Chinese government was so sensitive about this question that they destroyed any ability for the international community, for any independent body to actually find out. And then they went around the world blackmailing, coercing companies into shutting up about it. The Chinese government punished Australia just for calling for an independent investigation and decimated their agricultural industry in the middle of a pandemic. That's a pretty serious and capricious punishment for just raising the question of how did the virus start. Then they blackmailed the world with the masks. Remember those masks that in our factories in China, it's our factories, but not really, because once the crisis hit, we didn't own those factories at all. And they blackmailed the Trump administration, this is in the book, and said, if you talk about the origin of the coronavirus, you don't get your masks. Do you want your masks? They did the same thing with vaccines. They did the same thing with vital aid and humanitarian aid. And it was a pretty ugly scene around the world. And what happened was that a lot of countries, especially democracies, turned against the Chinese Communist Party because they realized how mean and punitive and manipulative they were being for their political ends, not for the Chinese rejuvenation, not for the Chinese economic success. It goes on and on and on. And now we're living in a world of misinformation and disinformation pushed by any number of countries related to the coronavirus pandemic. But why is the Chinese Communist Party trying to pretend that there's a chance that the virus came from Fort Detrick, Maryland, when that's an insane thing to say, considering that the outbreak was in Wuhan, not Fort Detrick, you know? And why are they creating fake scientific papers to suggest that it came over in a frozen food package from, you know, they're in the war of misinformation and disinformation, as you know, muddying the waters is a good outcome for them, right? The truth needs to be verified, but the disinformation just needs to confuse everybody. They don't want anyone to find the origin. They don't want any liability for the horrendousness that followed in their culpability in exacerbating the suffering. So that's what they're doing. And if you think about it, it's kind of crazy because one of the things they lied about was about the vaccines. They said, oh, the mRNA vaccines are so terrible. Now the Chinese people need the mRNA vaccines to get out of their lockdowns, and the government can't give them to them because they already spent 2 years lying about them. We have to see this as a sort of comprehensive effort to just take the world's worst crisis ever, which emanated from China, and just to destroy any ability from anybody to find out how we got into this mess. And of course, that's not just a political question. It's not about blaming China. It's about, if we don't figure out how the pandemic started, how can we change politics and policy to try to prevent the next one? It seems like in any disaster in the world, a plane crash or whatever, the natural thing to do is to figure out what happened so that you can make sure it doesn't happen again. And the Chinese Communist Party continues to work against that necessity as hard as they can, with the complicity of many inside the United States, actually, but that's a separate issue.
And as you said, the Chinese spin here is prodigious, and there are real consequences for not towing Beijing's line, as foreign governments and assorted diplomats are finding out. And here I'm thinking specifically about Tedros Ghebreyesus, the Secretary General of the WHO, the World Health Organization, who was a big booster of China in the early stages of the pandemic, but who has since fallen out of favor with the Chinese government because he's been criticizing China's so-called zero COVID policy. So what's happened to him? And why is Beijing so desperate to, quote unquote, cancel any such criticism?
You know, Dr. Tedros, the head of the World Health Organization, has never, ever, ever been accused of being a China hawk, okay? He is amongst the international organization executives who is most seen as being most amenable and most willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the Chinese Communist Party. And of course, that was a disaster in 2020 because he believed the Chinese government when it said that human-to-human transmission wasn't happening. And anyway, here we are 2 years later, and Dr. Tedros has been forced, I think, pressured, or at least felt compelled to admit that a lot of the things that the Chinese government said about the pandemic in the beginning weren't true. And not only that, he came out publicly and called for an independent investigation into the Wuhan labs and their possible connection to the outbreak of the pandemic. And the bottom line is that he and a lot of other people I would put in this category, Jeffrey Sachs, who was the head of the COVID Origins Investigation Commission for the Lancet organization, have now come out and realized that, you know, their initial stance, which was that we should believe the Chinese government and also that the lab leak hypothesis is impossible, that those things were misjudgments on their part and they have to correct themselves. Now, that what does that mean for Dr. Tedros? Now he's probably not going to get to be Secretary General of the UN. Oh, well, too bad. You know what I mean? That's the real reason that these officials are always kowtowing, that they're always giving too much weight to the what seems like clear Chinese Communist Party propaganda, even when it's proven to be untrue, because they want promotions and they're ambitious people. That's what happened with the UN Human Rights Commissioner. And, you know, I don't have to tell you, Ilan, this is the way that these multilateral organizations work. They go along to get along. But, you know, it's not really about Dr. Tedros. It's about the fact that there is no real objective organization anymore who can claim with a straight face that we've had a real origin investigation, that can claim with a straight face that the Chinese government hasn't amassed a massive cover-up and that continue to cover up a lot of important information about our public health. And that's, a small piece of a larger problem of dealing with Xi Jinping's government today, is that they don't care about your feelings. They don't care about what it is that international organizations want them to do. They don't care about, unless it's something that it was they already determined was in their interest. And it makes it impossible to deal with them on almost any issue, because if you can't cooperate on a public health disaster, Elon, what can you cooperate on? I mean, forget about nuclear weapons, forget about trade subsidies, climate change, pandemic health prevention. These are the basics, okay? And if the Chinese Communist Party is going to just gaslight the world and then refuse to do basic things that are its explicit responsibilities in terms of being a productive member of the international community to protect our shared public health, well, that doesn't really leave much on the engagement side and cooperation side to pin your hopes on. And that's not a good thing. We don't want that. We don't envy a situation where China's interactions with the free and open societies are just a bunch of gaslighting and propaganda talking points. But that's where we are. And that's a problem, but it's not a problem that we can sort of ignore. And it's not a problem that we can just say doesn't exist, because aside from how it affects our interactions with the Chinese government, it also affects how the rest of the world sees this important relationship, because the massive amounts of disinformation and misinformation that the Chinese are putting out in coordination with their Russian and Iranian and North Korean and Belarusian friends has a huge effect on a lot of these other countries that we're trying to deal with. And that's a huge problem.
And you mentioned the UN Human Rights Council, and I want to go there for a minute, because COVID isn't the only issue on which Chinese policymakers are trying to shape global perceptions. Another is the question of the Uyghurs, the country's Muslim minority, who in recent years have been forced into re-education camps, been forced to undergo forced sterilization, and an array of other horrors. And now successive American administrations have recognized what is happening to the Uyghurs as being a genocide. Trump did, and Biden did as well. What does this mean on a practical level, though? And what's Beijing saying about it?
Right. Well, you know, for 5 years, the Chinese Communist Party has been denying that it has any policies that abuse or repress or disadvantage the Uyghurs or any of the other ethnic minorities, despite mountains of evidence that are growing all the time that actually millions of them have been held in camps, that they're subjected to mass forced labor, mass forced sterilization, mass family separation, just some of the worst stuff you could think of that you could do to human beings. And that not only that it's part of a strategy based on plenty of leaked and public internal documents coming from the CCP of diluting in order to destroy the Uyghur identity, national identity, and their ability to exist as a semi-autonomous group of people in modern China. And my friends in the intelligence community always say that the Chinese government has a foolproof encryption strategy. They put things in their own language and then nobody reads them. But if you just read what Xi Jinping has said in his speeches, this strategy is clear. It clearly meets the standard, in my opinion, of genocide as the intentional destruction of a people in whole or in part. In other words, not all genocides have gas chambers. Not all genocides have machetes in churchyards. Some genocides are slow. Some genocides are conducted over time and by reducing the population through all of these sinister methods. That's what's going on with the Uyghurs. And because the Chinese government's policy is simply to deny that any of that is going on while actually talking about it in depth and to their own people in their own language, that's something on which we can't talk to them about. It's totally impossible. So that only leaves you with one set of policy options, which is to apply a punitive measures and to aid the people who are suffering. But we don't really do either of those things in any serious regard. So what it means is that when the Chinese government doesn't feel that they need to even say that, you know, up is up and white is white, that probably means that they think that they can get away with it. They probably means that they don't see the international community doing squat to force them to acknowledge the atrocities that are ongoing. And they're probably right about that. That's what's sad about the Uyghur situation, that aside from 3 weeks before the Olympics, nobody talks about it, nobody writes about it. And, you know, Congress passes a bill to stop forced labor and the administration doesn't really implement it. And inside the Biden team, you know, the Trump team was crazy, right? So you, Donald Trump, who I personally talked to about this in the book for the paperback edition, and he said, I asked him about the Uyghurs. You know what he said to me, Elon, when I said, what about the Uyghurs? He said, well, maybe the Chinese government doesn't like rioters. That's what he said. Maybe they don't like their borders to be porous. He saw it as an immigration issue or something. God only knows. You know, point is, he didn't care about the Uyghurs. But a lot of other people inside the Trump administration did. And they did things, many things, actually. The Biden administration has actually done much less. And the reason for that is that inside the Biden administration, as you know, there's a division between those who think that the priority is to import as many solar panels from China as possible and others who believe that the priority is to stop Uyghur forced labor. Now, the law is clearly on the side of the latter camp, but the policy and the politics are clearly on the side of the former camp. So right now we're allowing the forced labor to continue in order to get the solar panels. That's the decision of the president and the White House. So what all of that amounts to is a situation where the truth and the facts of the atrocities are not moving the policy for all of those reasons. It's just stuck and the Uyghur continue to suffer. And a lot of people inside of our government, as you know, believe that human rights are a complicating factor in strategy. But I don't know, I tend to agree with the argument that actually they can be an amplifying factor in strategy if it's used correctly. But for some reason, this administration doesn't see it that way.
But the narrative that the Chinese government is pushing is bigger still, right? It's not just about COVID and it's not just about the Uyghurs. And in mid-August, you wrote a terrific column for the Washington Post about what you called a charm offensive that's currently being carried out by China's ambassador to the US. Tell us about that. What's he saying and how is he trying to convince policymakers and journalists in Washington to think differently about China and about what China is doing in the world?
Right. Well, you know, part of how we started this podcast was talking about why it was that Washington was asleep on the China challenge for so long. How was it that we went almost two decades without realizing that the situation had changed and that we needed a different strategic approach? Some of it was our own woeful ignorance. Some of it was a lot of complicity and corruption on the part of those inside the business community on Wall Street and their associated paymasters who see the Chinese economic market as a lure that's too tempting to forego for any human rights or national security considerations. Some of it is because the Chinese Communist Party has an extensive influence effort to influence our policy and our intellectual environment and our information environment and our cognitive environment. And we don't understand that. And we don't understand how that's organized on the Chinese side. Now, when the ambassador from Beijing sits down with 15 reporters in Washington, as he did 2 weeks ago, and says, what are you talking about? All the time when these people love the PRC, they definitely want to be part of China. Don't you know that? You know, if you say anything otherwise, then you're just a cold warrior, blah, 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 right? That's the sort of tip of that's the part of the iceberg that's popping up above the ocean surface, okay? That's the part I'm not worried about, actually, to be honest with you, Elon. Now, because he sat there for 2 hours and lied to our faces, but none of the American reporters were convinced. None of them were like, oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that the Uyghur thing was all a lie. Thank you, Ambassador Chin, for taking the time out of your day to explain that to us. I'm going to go write that it's all a lie. No, that didn't happen. So there's a propaganda part that we can see, and that includes sort of the state media and some of the foreign ministry wolf warrior stuff. That's the shiny object that the chattering class likes to focus on, because that's the part that's like obvious. And that's changed a little bit. It's become a little bit more jerkish, or just a little bit more aggressive. And everyone's like, oh my God, they're coming out of their shells, blah, blah, blah. But what we're missing is the rest of the iceberg. And that is the United Front Network. And that is a network of organizations, proxy corporations, political figures, fake think tanks, fake media organizations, and intelligence gathering and influence peddling, and billions of dollars operates all over the world that we're missing. And that's how the discussion in Washington is really influenced, through Chinese Communist Party networks that are super organized and super well-funded. And they reach into our academia, they reach into our tech industry, they reach into Hollywood, they reach into Wall Street, they reach into Congress. And it's a loose network, but a large network. And what people don't understand about the United Front, which dates back to Maoist terms, it's described in Maoist terms as to use the party's friends to strike at the party's enemy. It's what Mao called his magic weapon. And Xi Jinping has a similar approach to this function of the Chinese Communist Party, is that it's not just about us. It's about how the party interacts with anyone who's not in the party. That includes the Uyghurs, it includes overseas Chinese, and includes foreigners like us. And it's all organized. And some of it, again, when you see the bots and the Twitter trolls and all of that stuff, that's the easy part of the problem. When you get to the part of the money, and you get to the part of the investments in sports and Hollywood and tech and Wall Street and the deals and the private equity firms and the way that the Chinese government and its associated corporations use our capital markets to raise the money to build the machine that's pointed against us, then you realize the threat is much more complex and much more multifaceted, and that the information piece, the cognitive piece, is the way that they have their objectives come out of American voices, that come out of American institutions, American think tanks, American schools, American research firms. That's why it's sinister, because it influences us without revealing as such. And so what that means is that we have to get a lot smarter about the way that Chinese information operations work. And we have to understand that it's not really just about the Xinhua article and the ambassador telling us that the Taiwanese people love the CCP. It's about how we protect our democracy and how we protect our institutions from basically what is an attempt to infiltrate and alter them from within.
Right. And all this brings us back to the beginning, because Beijing and Washington are now worlds apart in both policy and ideological terms. And I think you make a pretty compelling case that that's where we are right now. But what does this mean for U.S. foreign policy? Is the Biden administration responding to China's messaging well? And what more needs to be done to debunk this prevailing narrative that Beijing is spinning that you talked about?
Well, you know, I think the Biden administration national security team has what I like to call the best possible strategy given the circumstances. In other words, as long as this CCP is determined to get worse, as long as they're determined to be more aggressive, more repressive, more expansionist, and interfering in free and open societies more and more, what the Biden administration is trying to do, which is to increase our competition and confrontation of China's malign practices while trying to basically keep the lines of communication open so we don't slip off the rails into a war, that seems like a responsible way to go about it. But there are two big problems. One is that the national security team is not in charge of the economic policy, and the competition with China is an economic competition foremost. And when you look at the Treasury Department or the Commerce Department or Trade Representative Office, there's a huge gap. There's no credible economic strategy that approaches the region in a way that can compete. And the Biden administration national security officials know that, but they're not in charge of the economics. So that's one big thing. The other big thing is that in the end, the politics are overtaking the foreign policy considerations as the Biden administration gets closer and closer to elections. And what that means is that if you want to appease sort of a short-term desire to pull back and to reduce American commitments abroad, well, it's hard to do that and pivot to Asia at the exact same time. And the Ukraine war has sucked up all of the resources that should be going towards a bolstering of the U.S. strategic position in the region. And that sort of leads you to the structural problem, which is the unsolvable problem in the U.S.-China relationship, which we sort of have to talk about, which is the fact that as China expands and the U.S. refuses to leave the region, the tensions are bound to rise. And because the Chinese Communist Party shows no willingness to negotiate any true a compromise on how to manage those tensions, things are going to get worse before they get better. And people say that, well, we should avoid a Cold War. Well, to paraphrase Churchill, we may not be interested in a Cold War, but a Cold War may be interested in us. And we have to be honest about the fact that China and Russia are joining forces in this, what we can call a systems battle. You know, there are a lot of people on the left that are trying to say that we should back off China in order to fight Russia. And there are a lot of people on the far right who are trying to say that we should back off Russia to focus on fighting China. And they're both wrong, because it's both one problem, because that's the way they see it. And if that's the way that they see it, then that's the way it is, whether we like it or not. So trying to avoid a Cold War and preparing for a Cold War are not mutually exclusive endeavors. And hey, it's better than a hot war. And probably the most dangerous thing that we could do is to ignore the threat and lull ourselves back into a false sense of security based on the notion that China will use its power in a way that doesn't harm us. Because the long history of authoritarian dictatorships and the recent history of the Chinese Communist Party should prove to us that that's simply not the case.
Josh, thanks so much. This has been a tremendous conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And, as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.